Hello and welcome to another episode of Livewire's Rules of Investing. I'm your host and editor at Livewire, Patrick Polk. We've got a very special guest today, Peter Cooper, founder of Cooper Investors. Cooper's Brunswick Fund, which he manages himself, has outperformed its benchmark by more than 500% cumulatively or 8% per annum since inception in 2004. So what are the secrets to his success? What ideas are getting him excited today? And what's his big idea for the next 30 years? We discuss all this and a lot more in today's interview. I hope you enjoy the show. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I know you don't do a lot of media, so I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. First, a little bit of background. Could you give us a bit of a rundown of the history of Cooper Investors and how you first founded it?
Well, thank you, Patrick, for the opportunity to talk to you today. So back in 2001, it became evident that my career at bigger organisations was coming to an end. I had sort of three fantastic previous employers in the big end of town, and really in the middle of 2001 decided to found Cooper Investors based on, I guess, a collection of experiences, both investing and pre-investing career. I'd had a 15-year career in Aussie equities, worked at Bank National de Paris, Mercury Asset Management, and finally Merrill Lynch Investment Management. Had lots of fantastic experiences, not all enjoyable at the time, but certainly in terms of shaping and learning, they were fantastic, and particularly the global aspect. I think had many opportunities to travel and learn from other people in those organisations, and saw lots of things. And I should say, I started life as a public servant, New South Wales State Super Board, and people are often surprised when they hear me say this, but I actually learnt a lot as a public servant. And one of the really great things about State Super was a very long-term empirical research orientated, and lots of gestation time, I guess, to formulate ideas, and certainly had a lot of capacity to read and research other investment management styles and so forth. So that was something that was very formative for me, and in some respects at Cooper Investors have tried to distill the various experiences, taking all the best experiences and distill them in a smaller shop. But I just wanted to, in 2001, really focus and knuckle down on, I guess, investment philosophy, culture, and express that in a smaller organisation without all the, I guess, of pressures that one has in larger businesses.
Well, that was the then. What about now? Looking at it at Cooper Investors today now, are you still actively involved with the investment management, or are you more managing the team at a high level these days?
My role has definitely evolved. So my official title is Chief Investment Officer at Cooper Investors, and as well as being the founder and director of the business, one of the directors. I mean, what CIO means is really the custodian of the investment philosophy and processes. In addition to that, I manage one portfolio. So we've got five portfolios at CI. So I'll use the word CI rather than Cooper Investors.
No worries.
So we've got five different portfolios, and I'm the manager of one of those funds, the Brunswick Fund, and the other four are led by other senior portfolio managers. So I'm not involved in the actual stock specifics of those other funds, but I'm heavily involved in company visits and internal discussions and meetings, and really one of the passions, I guess, from day one, and it's definitely a lifelong journey, is really to take some of the investment principles, which perhaps we can talk about later on, and codify them in terms of a culture. And I describe our values of Cooper Investors as being a money-making system that we use in terms of stock picking, and we call it a culture of humility. And some people misinterpret the word humility as meaning meek and mild and overly deferent. Quite the opposite. I think of humility as being fierce, and we use the analogy of a burning furnace. So sort of quiet and cool on the outside, but a burning desire. And I think through the specifics of how we actually, organise ourselves, the type of people that we employ, the development programs that we have in terms of growing our people talent, that money-making system, if you like, is delivered through values. So we've got five values in total, humility being one of them, intentionality, curiosity of mind, being present and in the moment, and lastly, authenticity, and probably the biggest one. Well, they're all really important, but authenticity, honest people who are very self-reflective and honest with themselves is a really great starting point to building out relationships internally and secondly with companies. And so our culture is really the raison d'etre of the success behind the actual numbers. And so the relationships, we do 1,000 visits a year, and that sounds that sounds unbelievable, but it's true, across 19 people across 20 different countries around the world. Over two-thirds of the companies that we invest in are international companies. And this just goes back to the question, you know, why I started Cooper Investors a long time ago. I had a deep curiosity that was only fueled by my experiences at Mercury, which is a UK-based manager, and Merrill Lynch and Banque Nationale de Paris, by these international communities that I was able to experience, desire to sort of test out the investment philosophy that had been so successful for me in the context of Australian equities, and answer the question, can you actually deliver this system so it outperforms in international markets? And the answer after 10 years of actual international investing is absolutely yes. And I think we're really just at the foothills of that. And we set out, I mean, just to simplify, I guess, my career, basically it was walking up and down Collins Street, Pitt Street or George Street in Sydney, and you know, Brisbane, Perth and Adelaide, and you just sort of circulate around the markets with a very standardised, disciplined approach and investment philosophy, and really network and understand industry. And there's a saying around here, the best information's at the coalface of industry. And I to this day believe this. And I'll just preempt one of your questions, Patrick, what about the internet and, you know, the digital and artificial intelligence? Well, I'm super excited about that, because what we do, the value's gone up, not down, I believe. And so what one has to believe over the millennia, that human relationships drive humanity's progress, and that's the construct around here. Obviously, we're big users of data and so forth, but the actual principles, I guess, of human organisations remains intact, and we're investing, you know, very heavily in that in terms of building relationships with industry. And keeping in mind, this is a really key point, we're not traders. I think, you know, we live here in Melbourne, Australia. We make long-term investment decisions based on research and relationships, but we're not turning over portfolios rapidly. And that's a great advantage, because we can just sit here, do our work, either desktop or get on a plane and go and visit these companies and observe. And I think that through that repetitious work, juxtaposed alongside a very, you know, very stringent value set and culture, we on average can make better decisions.
Yeah, it's hard to find that kind of long-term thinking in today's world. A lot of people talk about it, but actually seeing it in practice is not something that's very common in this day and age. But look, I'd love to get into some of the specifics about how you and CI invest. So one of the things that I noticed when I was doing research for this interview was that there was, you classify some of your investments in using the same six categories as Peter Lynch. So I guess my curiosity is that a conscious choice, or is that kind of a convergent idea, or is it something that's been inspired by Peter Lynch?
I think the first thing to say, I think, we've definitely borrowed it off other investors, including Peter Lynch. I've said many times before, a lot of the construct around what I've described about the investment process is not original, but adapted to, you know, the personalities around here. So the subsets of value, and it's interesting, and we don't actually reference Peter Lynch, because I don't think he was the original inventor of those labels, but certainly inspired me. His two famous books, one on Wall Street and How You Beat the Street. I can't remember the other one, but you know, definitely love those books. Recommend that to any investor. I particularly love them because they're just so simple. And I was walking around a Walmart store 2 weeks ago in Naples, Florida, and I actually was thinking about Peter Lynch because in those books he talks a lot about, you know, getting around the traps and, you know, looking, using observation to see trends, and particularly in the consumer space. And I was sort of bemoaning the $2 tennis balls that I was observing in Walmart that I just paid $6 from a specialty tennis shop in Walmart. So you see a lot by just observation and getting around the traps and at the coalface. But the categories, the subsets of categories, are a very important way for us to simplify this complicated business. And so the way we think about the subsets of value is really a subset of behavioral descriptors that sort of describe like companies. And we like, and think of it as a library system of categorization, if you like, by putting similar companies that dance to a similar drumbeat within a category. And what that does is enables the scientific method, if you like, of observation, testing and review so much easier. And so looking at a cyclical company, a lot of the questions around where are we at in the cycle, are we above or below kind of an equilibrium level within that industry, have common substructures to them, you know, in the building industry, in the minerals industry, in the energy industry, as examples of cyclicals. And those learnings and those, I guess, questions and some of the behaviours you see in the managements of those companies are useful in terms of, because at the end of the day, you know, our I guess, overarching objective here is to find risk-adjusted value, what we call value latency. We could talk about that later on, what I mean by that. But that's it. I don't care if it's a growth company or an asset play or a low-risk turnaround. It's the value bit that we're really interested in. And and this would distinguish us from what you'd call a pure, I guess, value or contrarian investor, who I do admire, but where we've got a modified version of that because it's the behaviour that we're intrinsically interested in that sits alongside the value. We're not exactly happy to just sort of spend time in the market and wait. Even though we're long-term, we're looking for reasons and observable metrics in industry that would, using the cyclical analogy, that would lead one to believe that capacity, for example, which is a big driver of cyclicals, is reducing and not increasing. So we're happy to sort of miss the bottom, you know, the first 25% for a little bit more safety or certainty, if I could put it in those terms. So the categorization process is really about observing like behavior within groupings of stocks to enable us to make, you know, on average, better decisions, to help us learn, to make. I mean, it's so difficult, you know, if you're comparing a growth, you know, biotech company with a, you know, kind of a, you know, a building company in a, you know, in a country where building starts is going to range between, let's say, 130,000 and 180,000 on average starts per annum, like Australia. It becomes problematical to really evaluate the growth components, and I think the questions are nuanced, but they're different.
So, like, I guess a mental framework for comparing like to like.
Fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Yeah. Well, beyond the subsets, I notice you also like to use clusters. Yeah. We generally call them thematics because I think that it's a more exciting word for the audience, you know. Yeah. but I'm just curious, which of your seven clusters is the most interesting and exciting to you at the moment?
Yep. Patrick, I should say very, very observant, the comparison clusters and themes. We don't use the word thematic because it confuses people, because a lot of thematics, and not all, can get tied up in what I'd call top-down macro thinking. And whilst sort of industry analysis is really important to us, we're not so much into the you know, the top-down sort of geopolitical conversation. So that's why I would prefer to use the word cluster. Cluster is really, you know, an ability to sort of identify, you know, a narrative that runs through different companies. We've got a number of clusters that are featured, you know, throughout our portfolios here. One of them that's, you know, super exciting to us is the 1950s banking theme. And, it, you know, we picked 1950s because it's not particularly exciting from a digital perspective, but it's very heavy upon relationship banking. And I'll give you some names and examples in 2 secs, but, you know, these companies deeply, deeply understand customers. And when we visit these companies, you see it exuded in the behaviours and the actions from the, you know, the receptionist at the front desk through, you know, to the risk officers or the accountant or the CEO, the lending officers and so forth. So there's actually a religiosity or a sort of a spiritual commitment to customers that goes beyond MBA speak or, you know, McKinsey speak, not with deference to McKinsey's and management consultants. This is sort of management behavior at a deep, visceral level connected to customers. And so, you know, we've identified a bunch of companies around the world. There's St. James's Place in the UK, which is a wealth management organization. Handelsbank, which we're not invested in it today, but have been over the journey. Signature Bank in New York, First Republic, emanating out of Silicon Valley and US centric. These are examples of companies that are just deeply customer centric and people centric. They don't sort of grow for the sake of it, and so they've been able to, I guess, across their business, sort of lower their acquisition costs of customers, because a lot of it's referral based. They've been able to lower what I'd call the cost of doing business through bad debts or accruals that really infect so many growth orientated financials. They've been able to establish much better stakeholdership, not only with customers but employees who love working there. And so in the, you know, I think in the world of digital and social media, and they've, I should say, all of these companies have very strong technology underpinnings, but it's really to enhance the relationship as opposed to replace the relationship approach that they've taken and their strategy. In the, I guess, the Australian context, we've got a investment in a company called Heartland who have taken this approach, New Zealand based, but active now in Australia. There's Clydesdale Bank, which are, you know, have really, really tried to reform what was quite a dysfunctional subsidiary of National Australia Bank by going back to, you know, real basics of customer orientated and North England orientated organisation in the UK, who have, you know, really getting better at sort of identifying this relationship with customers is still very, very important. So that's one. The other one that we're very excited about is, and I think before I mention this one, look, it's hardly original, and, you know, you see it mentioned in lots of places. I happen to believe that it's just so profound. If you ask me the question, Patrick, you know, where did I get lucky in my 30-year career, and how am I going to get lucky in the next 30 years? This is the one. So the answer to the first question was, you know, starting in 1987, we got lucky enough to find a passion in a, you know, what I'd call a financialization. It happened to be in equities, but, you know, financialization of everything is, you know, whether it be superannuation or mortgages or, you know, stock exchanges or equities, everything in financial markets has gone up. And, you know, there's been lots of people lose along the journey, but I think that environment has been very conducive for equity investors and equity businesses, so I'm very grateful for that. I'm planning to repeat the dose in the next 30 years, and I think this point around demographics and the aging populations of every country other than a few around the world, And Australia is almost in the few. You know, we've still got a population growth going on here, but in large parts of Asia and China and, you know, Western Europe and Japan, of course, you know, you've got some severe slowdown in this demographics. But what's really interesting to us is all the behavioural changes, not just in retirement villages, but, you know, pharmaceuticals and social security and the way people, you know, are shifting their patterns of consumption, new products. I think it's profound, and there's lots of things that we haven't thought of. I came across a great stat the other day. It took 4 million years for humanity to increase the average age from 31 years of age to 42 until 115 years ago. It's taken us 115 years to add, I think, 32 years to it. And it's going to take another 20 years to add another 30 years. So if you're born today, people are saying, you know, you're going to live for 100 to 120 years. Just think about the implications of that for a long. And this is why we just love long-term investing. You can almost deterministically sort of see the structure of the demography around the world and really start to think about where are the pockets of franchise and opportunity. Clusters are really important. Our journey in this space started, you know, quite a long time ago in terms of, you know, companies like Cochlear and CSL and sort of more the device orientated companies, and then spilled over into what I'd call accommodation and housing through not only retirement villages but aged care and rental models, and have come across. And the clustering, what it does, it deepens your experience and nuance around what works. So we invested, you know, 10 years ago or more ago in a company called Ryman. I still nominate them as being the world's best in what I'd call integrated retirement village model. And if I had a dollar for every time competitors come through our doors and say, you know, we just do it like them and we're all integrated now, you know, integrated between sort of low care, high care, aged care and independent living, I'd be a rich man. But I think that, I mean, look, there are others doing a really good job, so I don't mean to just call out Ryman as being the only one, but they were certainly the first in developing this integrated model and the nuances around getting it right, you know, from designing villages to how you market to the clientele. Who is the customer? Is it the actual person living in there or the relatives? And giving you the hint, the answer is the relatives are a huge stakeholder. So that all the communication systems and marketing systems, they've thought about it, documented it, trained for it, and designed it into their decision-making processes, right down to a location, you know, the configuration, where you put the doorways into the independent village, because they don't, you know, independent livers don't want to see age, you know, high care aged care. And you'd be surprised the number of villages around Australia that actually have a common entry. It's a disaster in terms of, you know, putting off the clientele. So the clustering enables, and look, we're not geniuses around here, we just sort of keep on showing up, allows you to sort of absorb that wisdom through compare and contrast, and, you know, all that material just becomes long-term knowledge and wisdom for us to try and, you know, network around to look for the next best idea.
I'm so glad you brought up the issue of longevity and the ageing of the population. I actually just sat down with a gentleman from the UK earlier today to discuss the issue of the ageing population and the incredible advancements that we're seeing in medicine for late in life. So to our audience, please keep an ear out for that. That'll be out in a week or two's time. But I know that you're active in the IPO market, from what I've seen in your documentation, and incubators make up a relatively small part of your portfolio, but they're always an exciting topic to talk about. I was wondering, could you tell us about your philosophy about investing in early stage businesses? How do you separate the potential winners from something that's less likely to be a winner when you are dealing with early stage companies?
Yep. So I should say that you know, it's the subsets of value, and our investment philosophy kind of thinks about value in lots of ways. But one summary way to think about it is, you know, there's, I guess, reversionary value. And so this would be cyclicals or low risk turnarounds where you've got existing observable business models that are underperforming or not optimized or not realizing incumbent potential, if I could use that. So those sort of companies create value through improving sales per customer or margins or optimizing the existing balance sheet by, you know, selling excess stock or assets to improve returns. So that's what we would call reversionary value. And then there's value, what are called value creators, you know, people penetrating into new markets, new products, new regions, that type of thing, or the new, what are called the new economy. This is, you know, often you find a lot of the IPO markets sort of coming to the market with, inverted commas, a new offering, a new sort of sausage sizzle, if you like. So first thing to say, we're incredibly cautious. I don't like to say skeptical. Maybe a better word is discerning, because you know, so often the promise doesn't really match the actuality. A lot of these things are dressed up by, you know, financial engineers or dressmakers, and I would caution, you know, especially around the new listings or IPO front, you know, a level of conservatism around here. So with that caveat, Patrick, I would say, having said that, we're on the lookout for all the time for, you know, new opportunities and new models. I think that, you know, the reason the stock market exists is to really, you know, help capital formation and, you know, take already existing successful businesses to the next level. And so our slant on the IPOs is looking for people that are already successful rather than what I'd call, you know, listed venture capital, development capital, or the new mining company and so forth. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, but it's kind of outside of our investment philosophy. We've got this you know, category called incubators, which really can handle, you know, a controlled exposure, if you like, to some things that would be considered, you know, maybe slightly more risky than an established business and so forth. And the incubator term is really there, you know, it's an up or out philosophy. Okay, so, you know, we've got a short period of time. We do a lot of intensive work around IPOs. The shortness of time makes it sometimes riskier because you just don't have time to get to the bottom of all the questions one wants to have answered. So we control that through, you know, this incubation category, where we'll either do follow-up work, which will be confirming and will, you know, increase our position, or we, you know, move on. Recent examples, I guess, of companies in the category that we like would be Net Wealth, which has gone, you know, better than expectations, to say the least. But Michael Hein and his son have a long track record of business going back to when I started my career. So one can sort of refer back to those experiences and make some observations. Net Wealth is already an existing, very successful, unlisted, or was until it was listed, very successful company in terms of sales, winning market share, the underpinning technology. We, you know, we spent a fair bit of time with them within a, you know, a short IPO window, and that's a fantastic organisation, and I think they'll, you know, go on to bigger and better things over time. The other one, and both these categories fit in what we'd call a platform cluster. So, you know, whilst the world's looking at Facebook and Google's, maybe less so today, but you know, these big global platform companies, there's a whole range around the world, including Australia, of what we'd call, you know, maybe not as large in terms of scale, but same network economics. Okay, so where you get customers buying into a platform, you know, high margin, lots of cost sharing and leverageability and scalability from these platform companies, NetWealth would fit into that category. The other one we've invested in that we listed last year was a company called Elmo Software, which is if you're familiar with it, but it's a human resources SaaS model using sort of Amazon's cloud, if you like, to centralize and outsource the needs of SMEs. They're really targeting the sub 200 employee company marketplace, roughly a $300 million marketplace, and so they have a really, really successful observable model. We've kind of tested it ourselves around here, and they're now adding other sort of what I'd call complementary services alongside it. So they had a core HR, I guess, software package that helped onboard and keep record keeping of HR personnel records. They've recently developed and bought other adjacencies. So, HR testing, training modules, doing employee benchmarking across industries, doing compensation, short-term incentive management, long-term incentive management systems. So they're actually able to, a bit like the old McDonald's, sort of you buy a McDonald's and you can have some fries as well. Same concept, but within a platform model that's extremely leverageable.
I can certainly agree with you on the subject of Matt and Michael Heiner. I know both of them there. Got a great history in business, and as you alluded to, the Heiner family company goes back long before NetWealth ever started. So yeah, they're great people there. Yeah. I wonder if you could tell us quickly about the VOF framework and just from a practical point of view, how you apply that.
Yep. Well, the first thing, it's an investment process and a money management system. So what we're looking for is risk-adjusted value. That's the single overarching driver that helps us organise ourselves, which company visit, which piece of research that we need to do. It's the value and the risk adjustment of that value that we're setting our sights on. So that's the first thing about VOF. The second thing is there's two modalities of thinking. There's qualitative and quantitative. The qualitative vis-a-vis the 1,000 company visits and the endless discussions around intangible issues around here is really, really big. We call ourselves a qualitative led first organisation, and then validated with the quantification of value and risk and understanding industries and all the sensitivities. We do lots of quantitative work, but it's led through the qualitative lens of thinking. And then there's three processes that really sit underneath that. Firstly, there's the evaluation step around, how do we look at a company? If I was to summarize, our 1,000-line models, if you like, on companies, it can be summarized by three things. Firstly, sales, margins, and returns. So, what are the customers? How much do they pay for the product? Kind of gives you the sales. What's the cost base of doing business split into, customer acquisition and the cost of doing business? And then what's the capital, which is the utilization component? What are the capital requirements to support that business as a going concern and then to grow the business? And so, the 1,000 data points can be summarized underneath those three headings. And so we do a lot of work around the quantification of value and value latency. The second one is the O in the VOF, and O stands for operating trends, industry and strategic positioning. So always really interesting. So we've got a saying around here, observation, not prediction. And so we're long-term investors, but we want to see the color of the money in terms of the behavior around some of these trends that sit within businesses, customer acquisition, market share, just to name two. What is going on now? Because we're not interested in, unlike perhaps a more frontier-orientated investor involved in development capital, venture capital, we want to kind of see how we bridge today with tomorrow. So this is this operational observable trends that we see. Then there's industry structure. Is it getting more concentrated, more competitive, or less? So really interested to sort of understand the composition of industry and the behavior of the industry. So we like people who are, you know, conforming with what I'd call a profitable growing industry, as opposed to a profitless prosperity scenario where you get sort of continuous expansion of vision and aspiration, but at the expense of, you know, shorter term or medium term profitability.
Perhaps like we saw in the iron ore miners a few years ago.
Correct.
Is that the kind of thing you're getting at?
Yeah. Correct. So if you just drew which we did this work, you know, the last 20 years, you just add up all the CapEx plans, actual and announced, and there's two different numbers there, and chart those through time, you'll see a heartbeat for an industry. So at the top of the cycle, you know, just in that post GFC period, 2009-2010, you know, it's just incredible how much money people were spending in not only just the iron ore but also energy and so forth. You just couldn't get enough money out the door. During the GFC itself, you know, they were very wanting in terms of, you know, hitting on the many opportunities. Capital was scarce, but, you know, they were all too scared to spend the money. And so, you know, around that sort of industry complex, what you find is often, you know, at the top of the cycle, people are spending way too much money, taking way too much risk. And at the bottom of the cycle, they're too risk averse. And, you know, it's one of, we'll get to management in a moment. One of the things you notice, you know, in good management teams is that they really step up to the plate when perceived risk or ex-ante risk, looking forward risk, appears to be very high, but the actual risk is really, really low. And the opposite is true, you know, at the top of the cycle. And I think it's one of the demarcating, particularly in cyclical industries and CapEx heavy industries or M&A, you know, prone industries, you often find this phenomenon of behavior at an industry level. You know, when BHP or Rio Tinto spent a lot of money, so BHP and vice versa feel it's okay to go and spend a lot of shareholder money. They sort of validate each other's behavior.
A race to the bottom almost, or a race to the top, I guess, depending on your point of view.
Yes, no, exactly.
So how about the final part, the F in the framework?
We're looking for, once again, it's focus management behavior. So it's the focus bit and the behavioral bit that we're really hitting into. And so we want to find, you know, focused, passionate, knowledgeable, intelligent people who know their industry at a nuance level. And you know, we mentioned the Heiners before and Net Wealth. It's a great example. They really know their industry at a micro level, the relationships, the customers, the competitors. This fly-in, fly-out professional management team can work, and we have had some examples of that in turnarounds. Sometimes it's good to get external management in, but our raison d'etre is we want to work with people who really know their industry and know the nuances of industry. And so that would be the first bit. The second bit is, you know, how do you create value within an industry or within a business? And, you know, I think, you know, so if I jump around a bit here, just by way of example, you know, Macquarie Bank were one of the few people that wrote, you know, got the checkbook out in, 2009 and really, you know, really went for it in terms of acquiring opportunities in their zone of competency and within their, you know, within their sort of zone of interest. So, you look, anyone can do it, but it's really hard at the time. So, you know, I think having that sort of what I'd call value ethos is really, really big. And, you know, we saw this at, you can see this in, you know, companies like Macquarie Bank. You can see it in growth companies. I would say CSL, you know, has had a good track record of value creation, whether it be through acquisition or through their R&D department. You know, they've worked out how to spend a dollar, you know, where other companies just haven't. And I think that sort of level of focus around value, and I think it's a mindset and a behaviour and a culture of value, is really, really very, very important for us. We like management teams that, you know, have built up a I guess, a systematic approach to their, you know, how they do business around here. You know, you often hear it, you know, the sort of the Amcor way or the CSL way or the Danaher way as an international example. They build up a series of, I guess, management practices that work for them. And I think it's, you know, one of the interesting things about investing, whilst there's, you know, time immemorial principles, I do think that there's a lot of individual expression and working it out in terms of the people, the software, the hardware, the competitive landscapes. It's a, you know, a Rubik's Cube problem to be solved. And so it's not that easy just to sort of fly in the solution. And that's what makes it so, I guess, fulfilling, you know, as an occupation, to try and sort of hitch your wagon to these, you know, really successful companies. You know, I think the other thing I would, you know, just summarising this focus management behaviour, I mean, presence and we use the word focus, but it's being really, really disciplined and focused in on the areas where you can make a difference. It's interesting talking to management teams. There's a lot of management teams out there that are quite distracted. You know, there's so much going on, and separating, you know, what you can actually make a difference to and what's interesting in your industry seems to be quite challenging for some people. And yeah, you know, because it's complicated. But it's the good guys and the good girls work out where to spend the energy and the resources to create value, because nothing else matters in the end from a, you know, from an investing perspective. I think the other thing that would demarcate, you know, some of the management criteria we're looking for, you know, is sort of deep respect for customers and employees, particularly. Really, really want that. We just don't want, you know, I've got lots of examples of money machines, but you know, from a long-term perspective, you know, these guys either, you know, don't fit the ethics that we're looking for, or in fact actually running a, you know, a highly risky model that'll get caught out. So, you know, very, very keen to sort of find the, you know, the right behaviours and ethics of companies. And lastly, this thing, and some of these things, Patrick, sort of sit as contradictions, you know, flexible but focused, you know, sort of flexible mindset, but you know, disciplined and so forth. And so, you know, I would say one of the very, very good attributes that we look for is, you know, curiosity in companies. Some people might call it innovation, but they're even in old, boring industries, there's always a way to tweak the mousetrap to, you know, to sort of eke a better return out of it. And I think those sort of managers have that endless energy, and curiosity is a real attribute that we kind of look for.
Yeah, definitely. Look, I wanted to talk about something a little bit different. It's not something that we cover very often here on the podcast. We're primarily an investing podcast. But I think part of investing, you know, beyond investing for yourself, is investing back into your community and into other people. We've sat down once before and had a chat with the team from Future Generation, who CI are key managers for the Future Generation and Future Generation Global listed investment companies. But I wanted to talk a little bit about your philanthropy. So I was wondering if you could tell us about one of the causes that you support and how it's affecting the lives of the people who are involved.
Yep. Well, we've got a range of projects, but one of the favourite ones I like to talk about is YGAP, started by Elliot Costello, son of Tim Costello, along with a number of other of his colleagues. And we were introduced to that organisation through an employee here, and so our philanthropic efforts is, you know, a bit like our investing, is bottom up. It's not a board thing. We've got 14 staff on the committee, and I'm actually not on that committee. I have my own sort of philanthropic activity. But Damien Ash introduced YGAP through a relationship that he had with that organisation. We got involved both as a donor, a grant giver to that organisation, and exciting from my perspective, we're also a lender, and I'm pleased to say that we've actually got our money back. So we gave a low interest loan for them to start YGAP to start a social enterprise, which was a restaurant which was profitable, that has subsequently been sold, but profitable, very successful Feast of Merit in Richmond. And so we were one of the major financiers, if you like, to get that social enterprise up and running for a philanthropic. And while I was so excited about it, I really loved the idea of recycling capital within the social, you know, social community, social services community, including philanthropy. I also loved the accountability that the loan gave to that project, and it actually gave us the opportunity, or a number of people here, to actually get involved in the pre-feasibility or the feasibility phase of spending, I think it was like a $300,000 project to develop this food outlet, and actually get involved using some of our skills around here as investors in the financial modelling and asking some CapEx questions and so forth. So it actually made us feel useful in a way that just writing a cheque doesn't. So YGAP, you know, has been a massively successful youth organisation. Today, it's two things. YGAP, it's a fundraising organisation, so they have a number of fundraising events throughout the year. It's a multi-million dollar organisation, and then the money gets distributed through their, I guess, their business incubator model, which is based in Asia, India, and Africa, where they, you know, basically coach and tutor and mentor, you know, micro businesses through an education and assessment feasibility phase, and then for some of them provide funds. So it's an awesome model, you know, raising money from a rich country, distributing to people in need, and some of the projects are, you know, as you know, just extraordinary. And you know, you've got these amazing entrepreneurs existing in, you know, horrible underdeveloped countries, but the thing I really love about what YGAP is doing, it's a real empowerment model, you know, sustainability, getting, you know, bright entrepreneurs, giving them a little bit of education, a framework, and then some capital to go off and do great things in their communities.
Teaching men to fish, so to speak.
Teaching men to fish, it's exactly, and it's so, I mean, look, it's early days for us, but we're really getting into the assessment, the measurability, the scalability of projects using, and Natalie Elliott here, who's recently joined us to sort of head up the philanthropic effort and bring some credibility. So her and I are now having conversations around bridging the VOF methodology, you know, risk-adjusted value latency, bringing those skills and disciplines and processes to the philanthropic projects that we're involved in. And it's really exciting stuff, because I think the philanthropic community can learn from business and finance. There's obviously big differences, and depending upon the types of needs, different models that are required. But I think that, you know, we're not doing this in an arrogant way. You know, there's a lot to learn about the philanthropic sector. The need is huge and the problems are huge. But I think there's, you know, some really good symbiotic skill sets that we're developing here that can be very effective in the philanthropic space from a sustainability and, you know, maximising the benefit.
Sounds fascinating. So we do these questions with every guest. They're supposed to be a little bit of fun. So first of all, one of our key objectives for the podcast is to teach the audience something they hadn't thought about before. Could you tell us something important that investors aren't thinking about right now? It could be a risk, strategy, cognitive bias, an opportunity, anything you'd like.
Yep. In terms of the risks, I think the fact that we're in what I'd call expansionary monetary mode has lots, and you mentioned before, we're not this sort of top-down thematical investors, but I think, you know, availability of capital, you know, both private sector and government, the price of capital, being interest rates, are at abnormal levels, abnormally high accessibility and abnormally low price. I think there's lots of nuances in terms of how that translates into the bottom up and specifics. For example, you know, competition in the innovation and software space is just enormous. The ability to raise capital in in the innovative world and the new economy world is enormous, and that poses some problems and competitive threats to lots of organisations. I think in terms of the, I guess the software, you know, software space, you've got Netflix out there, you know, borrowing money and raising capital to invent and create fantastic, I mean, Netflix subscriber myself, you know, fantastic content. But that normalisation, you know, what does the world actually look like in a normalised world in terms of supply, you know, to new innovative competitive areas, I think will have, you know, quite a bit of impact upon the way people both fund things and consumption. You know, when I look at the cafes of Fitzroy, they're more expensive than Toorak these days. You know, the activity of people around, you know, their expenditure profile is huge, and I think risky.
Definitely. The level of consumer debt in this country is quite scary at the moment. So, second question, if you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Start early and read classics. I think, you know, there's just so much to be learned. In terms of my experiences, the mentorship that came through books was really, really profound. And I wish I had done even more of that. So I think that, and it's a remarkable, it's interesting as to the motivation, but people, you know, are so generous in committing to public, you know, it's almost free these days, wisdom. Whether you're talking about, Seth Klarman or a Peter Lynch or a Buffett or, you know, you can go on and on and on. There are some classical principles, if you like, that are time, you know, held for, you know, the long term.
Definitely. One final question from this section and overall for the interview as well, of course. If the market was going to close for 5 years starting from tomorrow and you could only hold one investment, what would it be?
It would be a cluster of what I'd call family link companies, and if it was only one in the Australian context, that'd be something like a Washington Soul Pattinson's. These are fantastic corporate structures, very unpopular amongst the proxy firms, and often investors don't like them because they're insiders, independent. Boards are questionable, although many of them have independently minded people on them that don't get sort of qualified, you know, by the more institutional mindset. So these companies invest when value's on offer, and then they are very conservative and risk averse when risk is abundant. They're completely opposite to the institutional mindset, and you see that evident in a company like Washington Soul Pattinson's.
And speaking of which, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, they actually sold one of their landmark Sydney properties last year, which they've owned for something like 100 and something years. So perhaps something to look out for.
Yeah, very interesting. And a sort of note in Hong Kong as well, some of that old family money offloading, you know, 3% and 4% yielding trophy buildings. It's just a point of observation.
Mm. Anyway, well, thanks very much for chatting with us today, Peter. It's been great to hear so many rare insights into your investing style and philosophy.
Thanks, Patrick.
Well, that's it for another episode of Livewire's Rules of Investing. For the next couple of episodes, we'll be going overseas to talk with two incredibly successful investors who are leaders in their field. First, we'll talk with British investor, author, and businessman Jim Mellon about the exciting science and investment opportunities in the fields of lifespan and healthspan extension. Next up will be Rick Rule, president of Sprott Global Asset Management and one of the most influential mining investors in the world. I hope you enjoyed this week's show, and as always, thanks for listening.